thanks for sticking it out to the end of the day. So we're doing good on time, so we can have time to go through some stuff and then have some time for questions and stuff. And maybe people didn't have a chance to ask questions earlier. They can certainly kind of approach any of the speakers and ask further questions. So, all right. So I had to title this talk carefully because I'm not a nutritionist, right? I never got trained in nutrition. So, but we did want to, I did feel strongly about maybe including something about food, because people ask us all the time, what should I eat? You know, what should I change my diet or not? Exactly. So, and we do have, I mean, the cancer center in the hospital does have a dietetics program. We have nutritionists on staff, and they're excellent. They can work with you to, depending on whether you want to gain weight, lose weight, whether your taste buds have changed. They're really, really good at kind of troubleshooting some nutritional issues. But you may not see them forever, right? If you're 5 years later and you're not really being seen in the cancer center, you need to have a plan moving forward of what are you going to do for the rest of your life in terms of setting up some good dietary habits. So I think that's what I kind of wanted to talk about. So I'll just give a little background. I'm just going to talk very general about nutrition. I'm not going to get into details necessarily at a very granular level. I did want to say a few things about vitamin D, because I think it's an important thing to consider, and I think probably under-advertised. And I'll show two examples of healthy eating guidelines. They're on, both available on the web. One is from Harvard, their food pyramid. I think it's the way that they've put together, and we'll see at the end, is really, really good. I think it's way better than the Canada Food Guide. Canada Food Guide, if you ever look at it online, it's just so complicated about number of servings and all this kind of stuff. So the Harvard Food Guide is good, and I'm also a fan of a physician in the States who does nutritional medicine. His name is Joel Fuhrman. He works in New Jersey. He's written a few books about eating, which I've suggested to some patients. He's also got a food pyramid as well that kind of gives you some information about what's good to eat and how to plan your diet. What I won't be talking about, I think, is really, I'm not going to talk about vitamins much, except for vitamin D. We could spend all weekend talking about, should I take vitamin C? Should I take it pill? How much? IV? People see naturopaths. You know, we're usually okay with that. I think just, you got to be careful, because when you're on active therapy, we're giving chemotherapy to you, right, and antibodies and other things, and we think we understand how those drugs work to kill the lymphoma, but we can only guess as to whether anything else you might take beyond what's in the diet normally may or may not either help that chemo to work or actually harm that chemo to work. So I tell people, you can see a nutritionist or a naturopath, I think that's okay. Just be very mindful of recommendations where we're not sure whether or not it's going to help your chemo. We don't want to compromise the effect of the chemo against the lymphoma. I think when people are in observation mode after they're finished their chemotherapy, I think most of us are a bit more relaxed on what they might want to do. Some people do take supplements and or not, but I'll talk a little bit about vitamin D as a specific thing that I think people should be very mindful about. So I'm going to start telling a little story. So, and it's not a story in humans, it's a story in rats. So once upon a time, many years ago, and it seems like a long time ago, but not that long ago, back in the early 90s. So these were experiments probably done around that time. So somebody in a lab in the States got a bunch of rats together. They were interested in looking at liver cancer that was induced by this thing called aflatoxin. Aflatoxin is a fungal toxin, and it's one of the most potent carcinogens available. So if you give animals aflatoxin, rats in particular, because you would never really want to give it knowingly to a human being. So, but if you give rats aflatoxin, you can show over time, over the lifespan of the rat, that tumors develop in the liver. And you can study the tumors, and you can see how many tumors developed, how big they were, and you can also look at how many tumors developed like pre-tumors, like before it actually became a tumor. How did the aflatoxin change the liver? And the reason they were doing this is they wanted to troubleshoot high rates of liver cancer in Southeast Asia, where these fungal toxins are perhaps more in the environment than they are in North America. So here's a bunch of rats here that got, that really nothing much happened until week 58, and then after that time, they started to develop a few of them. 20% of them developed liver cancer. Here's another set of rats here where more of them developed liver cancer. And here's some rats here that even early on started to develop liver cancer. So my question that I will return to this slide at the end is, the substance that was given to these rats was a substance in food. So the, you know, the question is, we're not rats and we can't do these experiments in humans, but we can try and look to experiments like this to try and gain more understanding about how food might influence cancer development or response to treatment for that matter. So the question to think about is, if I told you what this was in the food that they were giving to these poor rats, would people take this substance every day in their diet? I can guess what your answer is, but I can guess also that probably many people actually do consume this stuff, and I'll show you at the end what it is. This was the same set of experiments, sort of similar rats. They gave the rats certain things, and then they measured in this one, not really liver cancer, but precancerous liver lesions. So these would be changes in the liver that could become cancer. It's almost like when women have a pap smear and they have a suspicious pap smear, you know, something that's an abnormality there that could become cancer. They did the same experiments here. And these were actually the preliminary experiments of the previous experiment. And they showed here that depending on what they fed the rats, and all these rats got aflatoxin, you could really increase the appearance of these precancerous lesions, again, with the same substance. So the one thing to realize, I think, and I mean, this has been ever since Nixon declared war on cancer, well, it's about 40 years ago now, we know that most cancers are not related to genetics. I mean, what you've heard so far today is every cell in our body, whether it's a cancer cell or a normal cell, relies on its genetics. It needs to interpret its DNA code that tells that cell what to do. So if you didn't have genetics or DNA, nothing would work. So when I say here that most cancers are not related to genetics, means that they're not inherited. It's not like something that you directly inherit from your parents, like, you know, the color of your skin or the color of your eyes, for example. So most cancers are related to, or a significant proportion of them, to lifestyle and to things that we don't yet know how to measure, things that are unknown. But for example, lack of exercise or obesity, tobacco. Tobacco is a huge thing, and so we know how many years it took for actually tobacco to get labeled as a carcinogen, but tobacco is a very important one, and maybe less so in North America now, but in other parts of the world, it's a huge issue, and I think they're going to pay the price in the next 10 to 20 years. Excess alcohol is known to be a risk factor for cancer. The diet, which I'll talk about, and then, of course, occupational exposure, asbestos and other things that people unknowingly got exposed to led to cancer, so we know that as well. But we feel probably 30 to 40% of cancers we could probably prevent by changes in one or more of these lifestyle interventions. So you can imagine the cancer center being 30% less busy. That would be a big difference. So these are my own opinions, and I'll have to preface that because I'm not a nutritionist, so all nutrition that I've learned has been basically on one's own time. Because as I'll tell you, you know, physicians do not know much about nutrition. So probably the last person you should ask about diet is your doctor. And that's the truth, because, and I went to a good medical school, and it doesn't matter, you know, they don't teach nutrition in medical school. They teach cell biochemistry, and they teach you how many calories are in a gram of carbohydrate, but they don't really teach you what people should eat or how they should behave for that matter. So that's not, you know, medical school is really for acute, you know, treating acute illnesses. And so physicians that are interested in these types of things like lifestyle and prevention and all that, they've kind of do their own thing to educate themselves. But these are my opinions regarding nutrition. So I think the most important thing is to build your diet around plant-based food. And I say whole plant-based food because if you tell your kids to eat plant-based food, they'll love it. They'll just go buy bags of potato chips, and they're good. So eating plant-based food is not necessarily a good thing, because there's a lot of plant-based foods out there that are processed, that are garbage foods. So that's why the word whole is in there. Whole plant-based foods. So when you go to the grocery store, it's the produce section. It's not the section where things are in boxes, right? So that's the main thing to consider in your diet. I'll show you the healthy eating guidelines that I'm going to reference at the end. But things such as meat, refined grains, that would be kind of white bread, white pasta, and much of dairy, that includes milk and cheese, should be kept to a minimum, and I'll explain why in a few minutes. You should avoid sugary drinks, and of course, we know that. We know that pop is not a good thing to consume, but also fruit juices are probably less than ideal, because a fruit juice is not a whole plant-based food, right? The apple juice in the container has been, that substance in there has been stripped from its natural existence, right? And in fact, people have done studies looking at the nutritional value in juice compared to the original food, and it's night and day. In fact, when you juice something, you should probably throw away the juice and eat what's left behind from the juicing process. That's actually healthier for you, because taking juice out of something that has other phytochemicals, antioxidants, fiber, really robs it of its nutritional value. And you know, it doesn't take much to realize, you know, fruit juice consumption is huge. And it, you know, as soon as you walk into the grocery store, you see like the rafters filled with a million different fruit juices of different flavors, right? Pasta, I'll say here, white pasta, that's made from refined grains. That's not a health food. So if you really like your pasta, I would encourage you to eat whole wheat pasta or try some of the other newer grain pastas like brown rice pasta or quinoa pasta or something like that. I would stay away from white pasta. And don't worry about getting enough protein. So there's this fixation about getting protein. You know, doctor, my husband is not eating meat. Where is he going to get the protein to build muscles, right? So you have to think back to our ancestors, people that, you know, evolved through Africa. These folks back then did not have fridges stacked with meat, right? They would go out on a kill. They would probably kill an animal. That animal would probably feed an extended family of 10 to 15 people, right? So they wouldn't be going back and forth to a fridge to eat meat. And how did they get their protein? Well, vegetables have lots of protein. Vegetables have protein. Nuts are a fantastic source of protein. So don't worry about only having to get protein from meat. So I'll talk about that as well. Certain fats are good for us. So years ago, it was the low-fat craze, and some people, some nutritionists have said over the years, that was the worst piece of advice that anyone has ever given anyone, is to go on a low-fat diet. Because what happened 20 years ago? They said, go on a low-fat diet. What did people do? They ate refined grains. Obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, autoimmune disease, etc., all went up. Because certain fats are actually very good for us. And if you look at the Mediterranean diet, there are good fats in that diet. Avocados, nuts, walnuts, olive oil, monounsaturated fats, omega-3 fats. Those are good fats for us. So you should not really try and exclude fats from your diet. And vitamins, except for vitamin D, taking vitamins will never compensate for a poor diet. Because the food that is out there in nature has been designed, and we've been designed, and our body has been designed to process this food as it comes directly from nature. So eating bad food and trying to make up for that by taking something that someone has created in a factory somewhere, you'll never be able to catch up. So don't rely on vitamins. Now, there are situations where people may need to take a multivitamin because they have nutritional deficiencies, or that's a detailed discussion between you, the physician, and the nutritionist. But on a widespread scale, vitamins will not be able to compensate for a lack of a good diet, except for vitamin D. And I'll spend some time talking about vitamin D because I think it's very important. So a bit more of the background. I said physicians know very little about nutrition or food because we really honestly don't get trained for that. We get trained how to treat heart attacks. We get trained how to give chemotherapy, how to give antibiotics for infections. We're not really trained in medical school to be preventative and counsel people on good nutritional practices, which is why we need the nutritionists there, because they have training in that, and we really like working well together with them. The other thing we've noticed is that intake of processed food has risen dramatically in the last few decades, right? So just go to the grocery store. It's no mystery. Meats, boxed products, refined grains, things with added sugars. These are 90% of what is sold in grocery stores now. Nitrates or other known carcinogens, and high fructose corn syrup, which is basically in many different juices, pops, and I think that's a very toxic thing to be taking in. I think it's worse than taking sugar. So, and also the other thing is, I think because everyone's so busy, people eat out more now than they used to, and that's been clearly shown in the States in the last 30 or 40 years. People eat out more now. So what happens when you eat out? The portions are bigger, and they're high calorie meals. And the reason why restaurant food tastes good is because it's loaded with butter, salt, and other things that you probably wouldn't use so much at home if you were cooking for yourself. So people cook less at home, and that has changed the landscape of what people are eating. And here's some interesting trends. This is from the website, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I couldn't really find much on short notice for Canada, but I mean, I think the whatever trends we see in the U.S., basically they're more or less the same in Canada, because we're a little different, but we're probably not that different in the end. So you can see here that, you know, red meat, so they looked at averages, pounds of food per capita that people take. And they started in the 1950s, and they've gone to about the year 2000, and they want to see, you know, what are the trends in food consumption, right? So you can see the red meat intake has increased moderately. It reached its peak in the 70s, and then the word got out that maybe red meat wasn't good for the heart and that type of thing, and so there has been a slight reduction in red meat intake in the U.S. population, still higher than it was back in the 50s. And if you look at the type of red meat, the consumption of pork has been more or less the same. Beef consumption has gone up. Veal and lamb have gone down. Poultry has been huge. So what's happened basically, as beef consumption has gone down, that was replaced by chicken and poultry, right? Because it's the white meat. It wasn't felt to be red meat. Red meat was bad. So let's all just eat chicken, right? So the poultry consumption has gone up a lot. And most of that is chicken and not other things like turkey. Fish and shellfish has gone up a bit. And the consumption of eggs, you know, eggs have gotten a bad rap over the years because of the cholesterol business and heart disease. So actually consumption of eggs has actually gone down. So that's the meat. And these are actually pounds per person. So basically, if you look at overall meat here, if you look at these numbers in summary, so Americans now, and Canadians presumably, they eat an average of 57 pounds more meat than they did annually in the 1950s, and 30% fewer eggs. So 60 pounds. Let's just think about what 60 pounds of meat looks like, and just think that we're all eating that much more every year compared to 1950. If you look at dairy products, Americans are drinking less milk, but they're eating more cheese. So the one thing about dairy I'll just mention, two-thirds of the world's population is lactose intolerant. So they can't drink milk. So you got to wonder, how is it that a human species has evolved where the majority of people in the world can actually drink milk? And milk is perfect for a calf, right? When a calf is born, those of you, maybe somebody has worked on a farm in their life. So when a calf is born, it's a baby. And that baby calf has to put on pounds and pounds and pounds over their first year or two to become a cow. And milk from the mother cow is perfect for that. And human milk is good for human babies, because we have to put on weight too. But then when we wean from our mother's breast, our mother's breast milk, we don't go back to drinking our mother's breast milk. Like, who has cereal now with their mother's breast milk? Nobody. You'd probably be locked up if you did that. So it's a bit puzzling that we drink milk from another species that, and even adult cows don't drink their own milk. So it's kind of like a bit weird, to be honest, that humans are drinking the milk, but the cow itself isn't drinking its own milk. And anyways, I think that's just a little side thinking. It's a little mental exercise. But if you look at how things play out in the American population, then you can see cheese here has gone up a lot. It's gone from 7 pounds back in the 1950s to almost 30 pounds now. And cheese has been the biggest source of saturated fat in the American diet until recently. You can buy low-fat cheese, but the majority of it is still very high in saturated fat. And when you buy a quart of milk and it says 2% on it, that's not 2% milk. That's not 2% fat. So that would be like me eating, that's actually like 22% fat still. Because that would be like me eating a Big Mac and saying, oh, you know, I'm going to eat a Big Mac and drink a gallon of water, and it's all good. It's not all good, because the Big Mac I ate still has its fat content. It doesn't matter how much I dilute it, right? So there's cheese consumption, which has gone up a lot. Frozen dairy products here have gone up a bit too. And where's the milk here? Beverage milk has gone down, yeah. And sweet things. So I confess I have a sweet tooth, and you know, it's a struggle to stay away from this kind of stuff. But you can look here, high fructose corn syrup basically did not exist in the 50s and 60s. It was unheard of. It was discovered, I think, by some chemist. It was found to be a very cheap and efficient way of sweetening beverages, and it penetrated the market very quickly. And you'd see what happened to high fructose corn syrup, 5 pounds in the 1970s, 64 pounds now. So all of these sugars, these sweeteners have gone up. How about our poor fruits and vegetables? So here's their table. So they have actually gone up, but moderately, by about 20%, one-fifth. So there has been some increase in fruit and vegetable consumption, but not as dramatic as the changes of the other slides that I've shown for the other animal products. So total fruit and vegetables have gone up. Fresh fruit has gone up a bit. Some of the processed food has gone up a little bit too. Total vegetables. The problem with the total vegetables here, if you look at surveys of the US and the Canadian population, out of the vegetables that people eat, the large majority are potatoes. And the large majority of those are actually fried potatoes. So although you're getting some vegetable in the diet for the statistics, you're actually probably not eating the right vegetables. And I'll talk to you about what the right vegetables are in a minute. So here's one study, and I like looking at this study because there's, like I said, we're not rats. You can't lock us into cages and feed us whatever you want and see what happens 10 years later, right? Or, you know, sample our livers for that matter. So you have to go a little bit on faith that this is not like doing a clinical trial for a new lymphoma drug. This is really observational evidence. This is just looking at populations and trying to see what do they eat and then what happens to them in the future. So this is a study that was done in the UK, published in the British Journal of Cancer a few years ago. And what they wanted to see is, they did a survey of about 60,000 people. So they followed 60,000 people over years, and they administered questionnaires in terms of what they ate. And they were interested to see, you know, what cancers did these people develop over time. And they were interested in meat eaters versus fish eaters versus vegetarians. And they wanted to see, you know, is there a big difference over time? And this was a prospective study. So they kind of collected the data as they went. And the good part about countries like ours is there are cancer registries. So like in Canada, in Ontario, for example, whenever a cancer gets diagnosed, by law, it has to be recorded in the registry, which is held in Toronto. So, you know, there is accurate information about how many and what types of cancers develop in the population. That's required by law. That was the Cancer Act passed many, many years ago. So you can see here that so meat eating was felt, so that started, the risk of that was one, because that was the kind of control group, and the experimental groups were the fish eaters, because people have published over the years to say that eating fish is a good thing, and maybe it, because fish have omega-3s and they have some vitamin D, it's good for the heart, etc. So that was one category. Another category was vegetarians. Now, you got to remember, sometimes what people answer on a questionnaire is not what they really eat, so you got to take this with a little bit of grain of salt. But the interesting thing for me in this is they collected data on blood cancers. So they collected data on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, myeloma, and leukemia. And in fact, the changes that they saw in the vegetarians were the most pronounced for the blood cancers. So here, for example, for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the risk of lymphoma developing in a vegetarian was about 40% lower than it was in a meat eater. In a fish eater, it was about 15% lower than it was in a meat eater. For multiple myeloma, there was a huge difference. It was 75% lower, the risk of myeloma, which is a related cancer to lymphoma, in a vegetarian, and it was about 30% lower for a fish eater. So the thinking there is that maybe eating a vegetarian type of diet or a diet that has fish in it could be protective for some of these cancers. If I had a drug that I gave to people that would reduce the incidence of lymphoma by 40%, I'd retire. I would be a billionaire. I would make Bill Gates look like a poor folk, right? So, I would not dismiss the potential importance of simple dietary interventions. We're always looking for the next drug, but sometimes we forget, the big forest. What are the big ticket items here? So for any blood cancer here that they measured, there was about a 50% reduction for people that were describing themselves as vegetarians, and about a 15 to 20% reduction for people that were largely fish eaters. So what vegetables are good? I mean, all vegetables are good, except for your French fries, perhaps. But, the cruciferous group is a very good group. So these would be your broccolis, your Brussels sprouts, your cabbages, your cauliflower, your collard greens, your kale, your radish, your spinach, for example. So these are your green vegetables. And the reason why these vegetables are good is because they really have cancer-fighting compounds in them called sulforaphanes. These are compounds that are naturally in the vegetable. The thing about these ones is the precursors to the active ingredient are in separate compartments. So if you cook, say, the broccoli, if you overcook the broccoli to the point where you could mash it with your fork, you're probably not going to get the benefit of the sulforaphane, because the enzyme here, myrosinase, gets degraded by cooking. So you got to either have it raw, or you got to lightly cook it or steam it. And you got to chew it. Not that I've ever seen anyone swallowing broccoli whole, but that would be interesting to see, but I've never seen it. So by lightly cooking or eating it raw and chewing the broccoli, you're mixing the precursor chemical, glucoraphanin and other ones, with the myrosinase. That leads to a chemical reaction that makes sulforaphane. And the sulforaphanes are felt to be one of the good anti-cancer compounds in the broccoli, which is what gives it its taste. So why would broccoli have a funny taste like this? Well, it's for its own survival, right? The broccoli plant's sitting there, a rabbit comes along, chews on it, says, "Oh, I don't like that taste," and leaves, right? So the reason why some of these things have funky tastes to them is for their own survival. That's nature, how nature developed itself. So I think that's normal. So lightly cooked and thoroughly chewed is the way to go with broccoli. And people have done studies where people eat broccoli, and I'm not saying you have to have broccoli three times a day. People have done studies where you eat broccoli, you can measure urine metabolites of broccoli days later. So the effect is long-lived. And we're still trying to figure out what these chemicals are. So here is a little listing of different chemicals. And some of them are in cabbage, some of them are in broccoli or broccoli sprouts. And there's a whole bunch of different, it's just one chemical. There's a whole bunch of different things that are actually in there providing you benefit. There's a research group down in Buffalo at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute, and they've published a lot about broccoli and its extracts on bladder cancer. So there's a lot of medical type of research going on with these things. And of course, everybody wants to take a pill, but why take a pill when it's already available and it's extremely cheap? The allium group is another good group. These would be your garlics and your onions and your leeks. So these are an important group of vegetables with a lot of published anti-cancer properties. And again, these need to be chewed, crushed, pureed, whatever you want to do. Whatever liberates that vile smell that makes you cry, that's what's going to do the anti-cancer effect there, right? Because you're breaking down cell walls and you're releasing enzymes that convert one chemical to another, and it's those chemicals that have the anti-cancer effect. The Italians did a study thinking about the Mediterranean diet. This was a study done in southern Italy. And they looked at vegetable consumption, and they did it over about 20 years. And they looked at, let's measure vegetable consumption in our population. And I think they looked at a few thousand people. And they looked at types of cancers that they developed. So it's kind of like the British study, except just on a smaller scale and with a more restricted population, because in Italy, at the time they did the study in the area, I think they described this as being a Mediterranean diet. So the purpose of the paper was to describe what is the effect of a Mediterranean diet on certain cancers. There's a lot published about Mediterranean diets in heart disease, and if you read any of Dean Ornish's stuff, there's a lot of evidence about how good a Mediterranean diet is for heart disease, but they wanted to look for cancer specifically. So this is like the meta-analysis plots that you saw earlier. So what I'm going to highlight here is that non-Hodgkin's lymphoma were much fewer. The risk was, again, about 50%. Interestingly, very similar to the British study, 50% reduction in risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma with a Mediterranean diet. And they compared, basically, people eating the most vegetables to people eating the least vegetables. Because I think that's how you're stuck doing these studies. Because you can't feed people 5 grams or 10 grams or 20 grams. It's not like you can package it into a pill and be very precise. So they looked at the biggest eaters and the lowest eaters. So look at here, laryngeal cancer, dramatic. Colorectal, esophageal, pharyngeal cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, kidney cancer, and lymphoma. So a benefit in vegetable consumption, even in the Mediterranean diet. And then fruit consumption as well, the same population. And the only one that stood out for food here, not as many, but colorectal was better, esophagus, stomach, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So fruit and vegetable consumption could be protective against developing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And my philosophy is, you're going to say, well, what about people that already have the lymphoma or finished chemo? I think, you know, whatever works for prevention can't harm in action. So there's really no reason to doubt that there's any benefit to doing the same thing after the fact if it works before. This was a study from Europe called the EPIC study. So what they did in Europe was they collected from multiple countries questionnaires on hundreds of thousands of people. And they've been publishing on the EPIC study nonstop. So if you go into Google or PubMed and you type EPIC, you're going to get tons of references. They looked at EPIC, you know, for heart disease, for neurological diseases, for cancers. So it's basically a nutrition cancer type of analysis. And what they did here is, and I can't show you the whole study, but I'll show you, I highlight chicken here. So lymphoma and meat. And this wasn't about 400,000 people, because like I said, based on the trends from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, people have traded off red meat for poultry. So the question is that a good trade-off or not? And you can see here that it may not be a good trade-off, because although the numbers of lymphomas were low, again, part of the problem in studying lymphoma is that it's not prostate, lung, breast, or colorectal cancer. There's not hundreds of thousands of people affected by the disease, and so it just makes it harder to study. But we're getting there. I think if you look at poultry consumption here by grams per day, so I had to look it up. A chicken breast is about 200 grams. So even at 40 grams per day, which is a fifth of a chicken breast, and I don't know who stops eating just a fifth of a chicken breast, so because usually it's like all or none. So the risk of follicular lymphoma here, as one example, was about 80% higher, and that's only at 40 grams per day, and we can only guess at 200 grams per day what it may or may not be. So that was the trend there, an increase was statistically significant. And the other one was B-cell CLL, which is a related disease to lymphoma. That also showed a higher risk ratio for people consuming more poultry. So now, you know, diffuse large cell didn't show a big risk, although, you know, some of the numbers get small here and the trends become a little bit unstable. Like, you know, poultry here showed a higher risk for diffuse large B-cell, but not at the higher level. You know, it's really, so you got to take this with a grain of salt. Perhaps these are more thought-provoking. But an interesting observation that perhaps poultry consumption, it doesn't make it any safer. And if you look at poultry, you got to remember, you have to remember as well in North America and even Western Europe, but probably more so in North America. You know, where does the meat, where's the food come from, right? So, well, you know where the fruits and vegetables come from. They come from the ground. There's no mystery there, or maybe a hydroponic operation. But you know where meat comes from, right? It comes from factory farming. So factory farming is what it is. It's factory farming. So, I mean, I won't get into it now, but there are factory farming methods that are necessary to make, you know, the meat viable, you know, like hormones, antibiotics. The animals are in close proximity. They get sick with viruses. You know, some viruses can, you know, be damaging to cells, etc. So that's where the food is coming from. So, I mean, what I tell people, and some people really love their meat and their poultry, I say, okay, look, buy organic, or, you know, buy from a farmer you know of. Don't buy off the shelf, because the stuff you're buying off the shelf came out of a factory, you know, 2 weeks prior. I would like to talk about nuts, because I think for people that are really worried about protein, nuts are perfect. So nuts are nutrient dense. Now, you can't eat a whole kilogram of nuts, but careful nut consumption, I think, is critical. So nuts have fatty acids in them, fiber, they have vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, phytosterols. We're still discovering what's in the nut that creates benefit for humans. And there's a long history of nuts being beneficial for heart disease, cholesterol levels. It's almost paradoxical, because nuts have a lot of fat. So you'd think, but actually cholesterol goes down because it's a good fat. And there's a large study just published looking at nut consumption overall, and overall in cause-specific mortality. It just came out last week. One of the residents actually told me this was published, so I thought I'd make a slide. So this was from the group at Harvard. This was a combination of the nurses' health study, which has been going on for decades, and I think the physicians' health study, which has also been going on for decades. So they started this study way, way back, and they're just following nurses and physicians over time with questionnaires and see what happens to them in the Boston area. So this is about 76,000 women and 42,000 men, and they looked at nut consumption in women and men. And then you can see here that, you know, consuming nuts was associated with living longer, less risk of death from any cause. And if you looked at the risk of cancer, there seemed to be also a trend for benefits in people that consumed nuts for any type of cancer, and even for heart disease. Perhaps stronger for heart disease than cancer, but overall a benefit for both, without any downside. There's no downside to nuts. All right. So, vitamin D. Let's spend a few minutes talking about vitamin D. So vitamin D is actually technically not really a vitamin. It's actually a pro-hormone, but that's splitting definition hairs. And it's just amazing to me that we've known about vitamin D for decades, and we're still figuring out what it's doing. So if you look at and I'll show you a slide of the cellular pathways of vitamin D, it almost looks like a cancer cell, like what it's doing in there, all the enzymes and the things it's targeting. So we're still trying to figure out vitamin D. But basically, vitamin D, what we've learned over the years, it's got a pleiotropic effect on many cells in the body and organ systems. It's not just for the bones. It's way beyond the bones now. And there's two forms of vitamin D. There's the D3 and the D2. The D3 is what you can usually buy over-the-counter, cholecalciferol, and that's the one that your skin makes upon exposure to the sun. And it's the UVB rays in the sun that make your skin make vitamin D, and that's D3. So that's the one that is sold over-the-counter. D2 is also available. That's ergocalciferol. That comes from plants, so that's not from sunlight. It's less potent than D3, so you don't tend to see a lot of D2 on the shelves. It's mostly D3 because most people feel that's probably a better version. What we know is, and you got to think, whether you're an evolutionist or not, you know, when humans, you know, developed in Africa, right, and then migrated up into Europe. You know, humans developed in areas of high sunlight. And so if you were a human back then, walking around, minding your own business, probably over the course of a day you would get at least 10,000 units or equivalent of vitamin D3. So a lot of vitamin D you can get just from the sunlight. The problem with us here is there's no sunlight, especially now. When there is sunlight in the summer, we're all indoors. And when we're outdoors, we're told to cover up because the skin doctors have scared the living daylights out of us in terms of getting a skin cancer. And that's a separate discussion. But there's There's evidence to show that if you sunburn, you will be a higher risk of skin cancer. That's for sure. The skin cancers you tend to get with sunburn tend to be the more benign ones. There's a risk of melanoma as well. But melanoma is a funny disease. It's, you know, melanoma is often is seen in people, like if you look at workers that work outside in the field, say in South America, melanoma is almost unheard of. So melanoma is a weird one, and I think, you know, young women get it, they get it behind their legs. It's not necessarily in sun-exposed areas of the body. So, you know, that's a complicated discussion to have. But for multiple reasons, we just can't get enough sunlight. So we're kind of forced to take supplements. But if you were out in the sun, if you went out, say, in June or July, and you're kind of wearing shorts, you're not wearing a lot of clothes, you could generate easily 10,000 units a day before getting, you know, even your skin gets a little bit pink. So you don't have to go out and burn to get even 10,000 units a day of vitamin D. And vitamin D is complicated. So it starts off normally in the skin from ultraviolet light. The other thing I should add about that is you can't get vitamin D sitting in the sun behind glass. So as pleasant as it is sitting in a sunroom in the middle of the winter, you're not going to get any vitamin D. So that doesn't help. And putting sunscreen on, blocks out a lot of the UVB rays, which means you're not going to get vitamin D production. So that's another thing to consider. So what Michael Hollick, he's a dermatologist in the States who's done, he's one of the big vitamin D gurus. He says, go out in the sun for 15 minutes and then cover up. And then you're fine. But vitamin D gets made in the skin. It goes into the bloodstream. It has to go through the liver to become hydroxylated. And that's what we measure when we do a blood test for vitamin D, is the hydroxylated version. And then that has to go to the kidneys to become activated. And then the hydroxylated version and the activated version go out and they do their thing. So they work on the intestines, the bones, immune cells. And there's a lot of data regarding cancer and vitamin D, which I'll summarize in a minute. When we take it in from the food here, so where's vitamin D? Well, mushrooms have some vitamin D. Fish have some vitamin D, but you got to eat a lot of fish to get vitamin D. And then milk has vitamin D, but only because they add it to the milk. It's not there, it's not there naturally. And that's why orange juice has vitamin D, because they add it to the orange juice. So what I've told you, you know, you can just get your vitamin D through supplementation, and it would be very similar to how you're getting it through your diet if you're not going out in the sun. But the dietary D goes into the intestines and then follows the same pathway. So the benefits of vitamin D over the last 20 years are listed here. Bone health, prevention of certain cancers, in particular, prostate, pancreas, breast, ovary, and colon. And some people have said, if you could somehow get vitamin D levels to go up worldwide, you would prevent tens of thousands of deaths every year from these common cancers. Lung health, like infections, asthma, and wheezing. Cardiovascular disease and hypertension. Type 2 diabetes related to vitamin D. Muscle strength related to vitamin D. Autoimmune diseases, multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease related to low vitamin D. And mood disorders, underappreciated but probably true. Depression, schizophrenia, and dementia related to low levels of vitamin D. Here's a map. This is obviously the states. Looking at cancer mortality by, this is breast cancer in white females. So you can see which areas of the states have the lowest death rate from breast cancer. It looks like it's the sunniest part down here. The part here that has the super duper hospitals, Boston, New York, highest rate of death from breast cancer. So, and you can draw these maps. They almost look like the latitudes of sunlight, because we know once you're at Atlanta or below, you're not going to get a lot, higher than Atlanta, you're not going to get vitamin D for much of the year because of winter. Same for males for colon cancer. Same type of thing, where it looks like the mortality rate is higher in the northern states up here, where there's less sunlight. Same thing for ovarian cancer in females, and this. And yeah, so you can, these maps are all available online, and you know, it's kind of interesting data. And again, it fits with the theory that, and there's other studies, not just this observational data, to suggest that vitamin D has benefits for these types of cancers. So here's one study that was done. This was a prospective study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition a few years ago. So they took women, I think it was 2,000 or 3,000 women. They put them on vitamin D replacement, and they looked at how many women developed cancer of any type over the years. And if you looked after the first year, because they thought initially, well, maybe a woman had the cancer, and it just wasn't diagnosed, and then it popped up 6 months later. And does that maybe count against the vitamin D? Because the vitamin D didn't have a chance to do anything prevention-wise. So they waited a year, and then they cataloged the cancers. And you can see here, women that got calcium and vitamin D actually had fewer cancers than women that had calcium alone or women that had nothing. So interesting data to suggest a potential protective effect of vitamin D. If you look at CLL, that's a B-cell cancer. It's related to lymphoma. This was a study from the Mayo Clinic, big center in the States. And what they did is they just looked at people that came to their clinic with CLL. They measured their vitamin D levels, and they thought, well, their vitamin D level is good or not good or too low. And I'll tell you, if you look at the statistics in Canada, I mean, the majority of people have low vitamin D levels. They found that people actually lived longer with CLL who had come with a good vitamin D level compared to a vitamin D level that was low. And that's years later. And that's irrespective of the treatment they got. And this was in a large number of patients. The same thing for lymphomas. So this was a paper published a couple years ago by the same group from the Mayo Clinic. And they looked at people with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and people with T-cell lymphoma. And they measured their vitamin D levels when they came. And then they went on and had their treatments and they followed them. People that had good levels of vitamin D did better. Way better than people that had poor levels of vitamin D. Now, this doesn't mean that vitamin D supplementation improves the response to treatment in these lymphomas. This is just an observation that people that had better D levels did better. Now, why is that? Is that because they're more active and they're out in the sun? Maybe. Maybe they took vitamin D. Maybe they ate a better diet. It's really a little bit unknown. But this is a powerful observation, I think, because like I said before, if we had a drug, I mean, there's no drug in T-cell lymphoma I know that would ever produce a curve that would be that better, to be honest. So I think this is something to take note of. And people are worried sometimes, you know, oh, I don't want to get toxic on vitamin D. Like, how much should I take? Because the recommendations coming from government, they tend to be somewhat conservative. Because government wants to be very cautious. They don't want to say 2,000 a day and somebody has a kidney stone and, you know, they sue them or something happens bad, right? So governments tend to be very cautious. So here's what the published literature were to say. This is a summary of studies looking at vitamin D toxicity reports and the levels and how much people took. So what this is telling us here is if you're 10,000 units a day, even 12,000 units a day or less, there was no toxicity report. The toxicity reports are in the triangles here. Published toxicity reports. Well, maybe somebody got toxic, but they never published it. And I think that's a fair criticism. But nevertheless, 10,000 units per day or less, no serious toxicities reported. A serum vitamin D level here of 200 or less, essentially no toxicity reported at all. The average Canadian serum level of vitamin D is probably 50 or 60, so it's very low. So 200 is way higher than most people ever get, even with good supplementation. So a level of 2 to 400 or less, no toxicities. A level of an intake of 10,000 or less, no toxicities. So these guys have even gone even further. And again, this is from one of the vitamin D gurus worldwide. And this was also published. They're saying no toxicity below a level of 500. Which I think if my patients had 250, I would tell them, you know, let's back off a little bit. And no toxicity below a level of 30,000. But even that, I think 10,000 and 200 is really very, very safe. So it's actually very difficult to overdose on vitamin D. You have to go out of your way to take enough to cause a problem. So how much to take? So the problem with how much to take is that everyone's different. Vitamin D is a complicated thing to metabolize, and so giving everybody 1,000 or 2,000 units doesn't mean you're going to get a predictable serum level in the blood. And it's been made a little bit more difficult recently because the OHIP doesn't cover vitamin D testing unless you have some other issue. So the only way to know to get your vitamin D tested is to pay for it. I think it's like $30 or $40. But it might be worthwhile once a year to get a vitamin D level, even if it costs some out-of-pocket money. But the minimal levels, I think, for bone health and calcium absorption are probably 70 or 80, which is what our lab says is the lower normal range, 70 or 80. Anything below that would be considered low. So that's good for calcium homeostasis and bone health. But the optimal levels, if you start getting into the discussions about depression, cancer effects, immune system health, lung, etc., all those other things that vitamin D might benefit, then you're really looking at levels over 100, probably over 125. And so therefore, to get those levels, most adults need 1 to 3,000 units per day to reach those targets. So, but checking the blood level is really the most accurate way of knowing how much, because you never know, based on how much you take, how much is going to be in the blood. So what do I tell my patients? They ask, I tell patients when I remember, take vitamin D, take 2 to 3,000 a day, and then if I have an opportunity, I'll check the level once in a while. So back to our poor little rats here. Remember, these are the rats that were in that experiment many years ago. They were fed, they were given aflatoxin to try and induce liver tumors, and they were fed something else, and they found that some rats that were fed something had a lower risk, some had a higher risk, and some had a higher risk. So what was what they were fed? Well, that's what they were fed. That's what was added into their feed was casein. So what people probably may not know what casein is. So it's the major protein in milk. Right? Casein is the major protein in milk. And so this research was done by the group at Cornell University. So, and a lot of this is outlined in a book called The China Study. And he goes through his experiments. He's a retired professor now from Cornell Nutritional Sciences. So they were worried based on this that there's something in the milk protein that is promoting tumor development. And in fact, if you look at it, this slide here. So these little curves here. Now this was the same experiment done, but looking at changes in the liver before they developed into cancer, precancerous lesions. So what are these things on the bottom? So the higher risk rats, like the rats that had more precancerous lesions were the ones given C is casein. So they were given 20% casein protein in their diet. You can see these rats here, they were given, so they did it in two steps. They did an initiation and a promotion. So they changed the diet twice to see whether you needed the protein, whether you could reverse the changes if you reverse the protein later type of thing. So there was a two-step experiment. So you can see here, people that got gluten, which is a plant protein, right? It's from wheat. The rats that got gluten had very low risk of precancerous lesions, even though they all got aflatoxin, they all got their carcinogen, right? People that got casein, the rats, sorry, not people. rats that got casein and then gluten, actually, their rates of precancerous lesions were also low. The rats that got casein and then gluten, which you thought would be like this, but then they added lysine. Lysine's an amino acid, so that wasn't a good idea because that increased the risk of precancerous lesions. Rats that got low levels of casein, starting at 20%, but then only 5%, actually had a low risk of precancerous, and then rats that got casein at 20/20 had a high risk of precancerous lesions. A kind of an interesting experiment to look at the effects of different types of protein, whether it's an animal protein or versus a plant protein. So in his book, he really makes a hard case about limiting the protein by calories in your diet to say 10 or 12%, because when they went over to China and they did all the epidemiological studies, they found that people in China back then, maybe not so much now, they died of different diseases than what people die of in North America. So heart disease, breast cancer, even appendicitis, these are considered lifestyle diseases in North America and not in China. So the Chinese protein intake was around the 10 to 12%. And when they migrated to the cities and they ate more animal products, because it's very easy if you're eating an animal product to boost up your protein. It's very easy. It's almost too easy. And then, so then they found that people migrating to the cities actually had higher risk of cancer, and they started to become more like North Americans. So it's an interesting observation. So just to finish the last couple minutes, so here's one. I like this from Harvard. This is their healthy eating plate. Now the USDA has one as well, and it looks very similar to this, except the reason I like this one more is it's got water in here, and the USDA one has a big glass of milk. So you've already heard about my concerns about dairy intake, so I like this one better. And in fact, the guys that work on this, the Harvard School of Public Health has done an amazing amount of work over the years publishing on nutrition, so I really trust them. But here's your whole grains, there's your healthy protein, and what's there? Healthy protein, fish. Now, they have poultry in there, which I showed you something that might be a bit thought-provoking. Beans. I didn't talk about beans, but beans and nuts should be your go-to for your protein. Limit your red meat and cheese. Avoid bacon, cold cuts, and other processed meats, right? That's your healthy protein. Your fruits are your fruits. Your vegetables are your vegetables. And they say here, potatoes and french fries don't count. So the more veggies, the better. The variety, the better. And the green ones are good. Whole grains are whole grains. Whole wheat bread, whole grain pasta, and brown rice. Limit refined grains. Avoid sugary drinks. Drink water. And limit milk or dairy, one to two servings per day. And juice, like I said, one small glass a day. So not a lot of juice. And then healthy oils here. So these are olive oil and canola oil, right? Not other types of oils, because those seem to be the healthier ones. And Fuhrman's pyramid even is more aggressive than that, because he really thinks that 50% of your calories should be from vegetables. And in fact, half of them should be raw, like a salad, and half of them cooked. Now, a lot of vegetables, like kale, you can cook kale and get away with it. It retains a lot of its nutritional value. But like you said, broccoli kind of loses a little bit. So this is all on his website. So vegetables are the main go here. And then there's your fruit and your nuts. Beans for your protein, and then for your fruit. And then there's more seeds and nuts and avocados there. Whole grains and potatoes. And then the stuff at the top is the stuff that you should be consuming less. So that includes your red meat, your sweets, your cheese, your processed foods, rarely, he says. And then less than 10% of your calories, eggs, fish, and fat-free dairy. So he says dairy, he says, is okay, but fat-free to avoid that saturated fat. So that's his food pyramid. I think that's quite a reasonable way that he's presented. And he also excludes white potatoes here in the vegetables. And like I've said, unfortunately, white vegetables are a common vegetable, but it's not really a vegetable in a way. So if you cook a white potato and you eat it, and you look at the what gets absorbed, it's kind of like more, it's too starchy. It's more sugary, so it's like eating white bread. So it's probably best to avoid potatoes, and certainly if they're deep fried, that's no better. So that's all. That's a whirlwind tour of nutrition. So thanks for your attention, and I can certainly take any questions.